From PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Parent. Indonesia's Foreign Minister, Marty Nakarawala, has received presidential backing for his stand that the country needs to review its cooperation with Australia on people smuggling and terrorism. A spokesman for President Suyo Bangayanahono says Jakarta is speaking with one voice on the issue. The statements came after reports emerged that Australia's Jakarta embassy has allegedly been spying on operations. George Roberts has more.
Marty Natalegawa says it's a fair assumption that Australia was and still is spying on Indonesia.
In the absence of such assurances, to the contrary, then of course we must assume that such activities are taking place.
Reports that Australia and the United States had been running surveillance operations from their Jakarta embassies prompted Indonesia to demand explanations. But the foreign minister says neither country would confirm or deny it. Marty Natalegawa told local journalists it's time to rethink cooperating with countries that play outside the rules.
Kita perlu mengkaji ulang.
We need to review our cooperation, the cooperation on information exchange with those countries, either Australia or America, because if they are doing information gathering beyond the official cooperation framework, the question is, what's the point of having an official cooperation framework?
He says he's already started considering what might need reviewing.
I was looking at Indonesia, Australia, the various agreements the two countries have committed themselves. One of them, obviously, is agreement to exchange information, exchange even intelligence information, to address issues such as people smuggling, for example, to disrupt people smuggling, to disrupt terrorist attacks, etc. Now, this information flow have been rather effective, rather important. We need to look at that.
Over the years, Australia's provided investigation, intelligence and forensic training, as well as office equipment and vehicles worth about $500,000 to Indonesia's anti-terrorism squad, Detachment 88. While the group is criticised for often killing suspects in shootouts, Detachment 88 is also now considered one of the most successful in the world for shutting down terrorism cells. On the other hand, since the start of September, Indonesian police are understood to have arrested 8 people smugglers and prevented 25 asylum seeker boats from leaving for Australia. Marty Natalegawa says the spy reports have threatened that.
If Australia feels that there are ways of obtaining information other than the official one, then one wonders where we are in terms of cooperation.
Late last night, a spokesman for the president, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, confirmed via text message that the foreign minister's view reflects that of the president, saying, "We speak in unison with one voice."
That was George Roberts reporting from Indonesia. Fears are mounting of a return of political unrest in Thailand, after thousands recently rallied in Bangkok to oppose the government's bid to give amnesty to the former leader, Thaksin Shinawatra. The government, led by Thaksin's sister Yingluck, has pushed through a revised amnesty law in the parliament that would apply to all people involved in the years of political upheaval, including political leaders. That would allow billionaire former prime minister to return from exile. The government appears to have the numbers to pass the bill, but the opposition is still determined to stop it. Bill Birtles reports.
Thai media reports say more than 10,000 people turned out at Bangkok's Samsen railway station for last night's protest, in what organisers hope will become a permanent demonstration until the government's controversial amnesty bill is withdrawn. The bill, before the parliament, has the support of the ruling Pu Thai party, and it would grant amnesty to those involved in the political upheaval that began with the 2006 coup. Most controversially, it would absolve the billionaire former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra of his corruption convictions and allow him to return home from exile in Dubai. Korn Chirakawani is the Deputy Democrat Party leader and former Finance Minister. He says the potential return of Thaksin Shinawatra is highly divisive.
What we're finding is that now that it has become clear what this amnesty bill is all about, and essentially it's not just about providing amnesty to individuals who attended rallies and may have inadvertently broken laws, but it is specifically setting out to absolve ex-leader, particularly ex-Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra, from his conviction for crimes related to corruption. This has sparked really a very broad-based sense of indignation right across the different segments of Thai societies.
And I understand that some segments of the red shirt movement are also opposed to this amnesty bill. How significant is that?
I think that's also quite significant. They are opposing it because they don't believe a blanket amnesty before fact-finding and the judicial process has run its course, in at least in finding the guilty party, and that no amnesty should be given until that process has been completed, which we agree with. So the fact that Thaksin has played his hands, that he's willing to compromise Red Shirt's demand for justice to serve his own personal ends, has really, I think, woken up a very large number of thinking Red Shirts.
Are you concerned that this issue of amnesty and the potential of Thaksin's return could lead to more unrest?
Well, we are seeing it already. I mean, this is what we've been telling the Pratai Party in Parliament for the past several weeks. We're saying that the country is facing all manner of problems. The economy is down. Cost of living has gone up. And yet they've been spending the past 2 months in power concentrating on pushing through constitutional amendments and laws to serve their own ends and serve the ends of their party leader. This is going to cause nothing but trouble.
And the political pressure is rising on Thailand's opposition, with leader and former Prime Minister Abhisit Vejjachiwa, along with his former deputy, charged this week over the deaths of around 90 protesters in the 2010 crackdown on the Red Shirt movement. They've pledged to fight the charges, which Korn Chattakawani says are politically motivated.
Yes, the charges were obviously originally designed to force them to a negotiating table, to force them to accept amnesty. But these two individuals have made it very clear from the outset that they don't want amnesty, that they're very confident that the charges are without merit. They were acting within the laws as Prime Minister and Deputy Prime Minister in trying to restore peace at the time of the Red Shirt protests in central Bangkok. And they're willing to argue that case in the court.
A European parliamentary delegation says the Lao government has yet failed to offer credible explanation as to the whereabouts of a well-known human rights activist. It's almost 11 months ago since the disappearance of the internationally recognized development worker and teacher Sombath Somphone. And the second time this year, the European delegation has visited Laos to press authorities on the case of the missing activist. But they say little progress has been made. Tom Maddox picks up the story.
In August, a European parliamentary delegation drew the conclusion that Lao authorities were still in a state of denial about the disappearance of Sombath Somphone. The delegation was led by Danish Member of Parliament Søren Sondergaard.
Our key message was that it is impossible in a country like theirs to accept that a person can disappear a few meters in front of a police control station, taken on camera. Everything is taken on camera, and despite of that, 8 months have gone without any results in the investigation.
And now, almost 11 months on since Sombath Somphone's apparent abduction, it seems the message is not getting through.
In our view, it seems to be impossible that the government knows nothing on this case. It was a disappearance under the guise of the Laos police. And we say to the government, we need a life sign, first of all. We need a life sign of Sombath.
Werner Langen led the latest effort to find out what happened. His delegation met with the parliament, government and civil society. The case of Sombath Somphone was at the top of the agenda. Soon after his disappearance on a busy road in the capital Vientiane on the 15th of December last year, CCTV footage surfaced. It shows Sombath Somphone being stopped at a police checkpoint on the way home from his office before being taken away in a truck by two unidentified men. A sophisticated forensic analysis of the footage has not yet been made. Laotian authorities continue to refuse offers of technical assistance from the EU and the United States. As chairman of the ASEAN delegation in the European Parliament, Werner Langen says Laos could become isolated in ASEAN if the human rights situation in the country fails to improve. The EU is one of the largest donors to Laos, and when the Parliament meets in the next month or so, Werner Langen says the EU's sizable support might well be reviewed.
Inside the European Parliament, we need more access and better regulation on human rights. The European Union has opened a delegation in 2003 and is giving an average of nearly 16 million euros per year.
To coincide with the latest delegation to Laos, rights groups urged the EU to use all its leverage. Amnesty International was one of those groups. They've welcomed renewed pressure on the case of Sombat Somphone, but they say the EU needs to go beyond just raising the case. Concrete questions need to be asked. Amnesty's researcher for Laos is Rupert Abbott.
There are a lot of outstanding questions around Sombat's disappearance, including, you know, why can't any of us see the original CCTV footage, the traffic camera footage that captured him being taken from a police post? Why can't the family see that? Why can't other countries help with analysing that footage to find out who might have been responsible for taking Sombat? You know, we welcome the fact that many countries had raised the case when it happened, raised their concern. But what we found is that often it stopped at that. But it's kind of an item on the agenda when foreign dignitaries meet with their Lao counterparts, and then kind of that's it.
Ong Shui Meng is the wife of Sombat Somphone. Last month, she told The Age newspaper in Australia that if her husband is returned, they will leave Laos and retire quietly. Every day since Sombat disappeared has been an eternity of waiting, she said, wavering between hope and despair. European delegation chair Werner Langen says the Laos government needs to give a sign that Sombat is still alive.
I think the government could be a deliverer.
Why do you think that? What indication have they given you?
No concrete indications. That is a problem.
So why do you say that?
Our ambassador in Laos is also on the way to discuss it with authorities in Laos, and we hope that Sombat could be. I don't know exactly. We don't have a life sign at the moment, and we hope that Sombat could be come back to his family.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. It was one of the terrible byproducts of the radioactive fallout from the catastrophic nuclear accident in Chernobyl. Now researchers in Fukushima on the Pacific coast of Japan are uncovering higher than expected rates of thyroid cancer in children. One predominant thyroid surgeon, a veteran of the Chernobyl disaster, says the number of cancer cases in Fukushima are emerging faster than expected. But another cancer specialist says the high rate is simply a product of widespread sensitive screening and no one should be alarmed. Mark Willisey from Tokyo reports.
2-year-old Yuta Koike is having none of it. Every time the nurse tries to run the probe over his neck, he cries, kicks, and tries to slide off the bed. His mother, Tomiko Koike, has brought Yuta and his 4-year-old sister Saki in for a thyroid gland screening because she fears the fallout from the nearby Fukushima nuclear plant. I'm worried, she tells me, but I believe they're okay. I'm hoping they're okay, she adds. Before the nuclear meltdowns, health authorities estimated thyroid cancer rates among Fukushima's children at between 1 and 2 cases in every million. Since the disaster, the Fukushima local government has carried out a large-scale screening program, and with about 200,000 children tested, there have been 18 confirmed cases of thyroid cancer and 25 more suspected cases, an unexpectedly high rate. Akira Suganoya is the mayor of Matsumoto City in Nagano, but he's also a respected thyroid surgeon who spent 5 years treating children in Ukraine and Belarus who developed thyroid cancer after the Chernobyl disaster. When I look at Fukushima now, The number of thyroid cancer cases in kids is quite high, says Dr. Suganoya. It's also happening fast. The doctors in Fukushima say that it shouldn't be emerging this fast, so they say it's not related to the accident. But that's very unscientific, and it's not a reason that we can accept, he says. But other experts believe there's nothing to fear.
Following Fukushima, I doubt that there'll be any rise in thyroid cancers in Japan. And this is simply because the amount of radioiodine that was released post-Fukushima was much, much less than released post-Chernobyl.
Professor Geraldine Thomas is a specialist in the molecular pathology of cancer at Imperial College London. She also helped establish the Chernobyl Tissue Bank, which analyses samples from people exposed to radiation after the nuclear disaster in 1986. She argues that there's a simple reason for the higher-than-expected incidence of thyroid cancer among Fukushima's children.
If you look for a problem, especially if you use an incredibly sensitive technique, which is what the Japanese are actually doing, you will find something. And you have to be careful you don't overinterpret that and worry people unnecessarily.
Everyone agrees that what's most important is detecting thyroid cancers early, because if found in the early stages, it's almost always successfully treated. But as Foreign Correspondent discovered, Fukushima's health authorities are acting almost in secret, even refusing our request for a simple age breakdown of the thyroid cancer victims, citing privacy reasons. This refusal to share basic data has aroused the suspicions of thyroid specialist Akira Suganoya. I'm still very angry, says Dr. Suganoya. I'm a thyroid specialist and I'd like to know what's happening. I think they have this data, so it's very strange why they won't release it, he says. And it's not just the thyroid data that's been kept secret. So too were the initial meetings of the Fukushima panel charged with screening the region's children. For parents like Tomoko Koike, who are worried about the effect of the fallout on their young children, it smells like a cover-up. I do not think they're telling us everything, she says. I cannot trust what they say. So it makes me worry about my kids' future. It depresses me, she says. Adding to that worry for Tomoko Koike has been the discovery of cysts on the thyroid gland of her 4-year-old daughter, Saki. While not regarded as malignant, the cysts will have to be monitored in the months and possibly years to come.
It's estimated that globally, 5 million people die each year from injury, and 1 in 10 deaths occur in India. Now the Australian and Indian governments have intensified collaboration to better care for injured people. The program is led by the National Trauma Research Institute, jointly set up by the Alfred Hospital and the Moishe University, and the All India Institute of Medical Sciences in New Delhi. Sen Lam speaks to trauma surgeon Professor Russell Grun, involved in the project.
We think about it from a worldwide perspective. Over 5 million people die every year from injury. The leading cause of that is road traffic accidents. The numbers of people injured or dying in road traffic accidents is increasing dramatically in countries like India and China as a consequence of industrialization. Of the 5 million or so people who die in the world every year, at least 1 in 10 of them occur in India, with road trauma, with workplace accidents, and with falls as the leading causes of injury death. And of course, when people are severely injured, if they survive, many are permanently and severely disabled. And therefore, in almost all countries, Australia included, injury is the leading cause of productive years of life lost. That's because it affects predominantly young people, and particularly young men, who are the breadwinners of families. And so an accident on the roads or at the workplace to a father and husband can actually affect the potential for a whole family to thrive.
And not to mention the national economy as well.
So the estimates of the cost of injury are dramatic. In Australia, we think it's about an $18 billion a year problem. The hospital-related costs are second only to cardiovascular disease. The lifetime costs for patients and their families are incalculable. And, of course, the degree of suffering, it's hard to put a dollar figure on that. In India, we're talking about a degree of magnitude many, many times worse. In the order of 3 to 4% of the GDP is lost due to injury every year in India.
And Professor, Australia and India are devoting over $2.5 million this year towards trauma care. Can you tell us about this collaboration? What's the focus here?
Actually, both countries invest a lot of money in trauma care. This is a research program developed jointly by the National Trauma Research Institute in Australia and the All India Institute of Medical Sciences in India, that's been sponsored by the Australian and Indian Departments of Science and Technology, that lead to, hopefully, better ways of caring for patients. We have particular expertise in Australia on understanding how to improve the systems of care for trauma. As you can imagine, then, if someone's severely injured, they usually have a number of different injuries, all of which need to be treated. Some need to be treated really urgently and some less urgently. And so it's not usually any one particular treatment, like a drug or an operation, that is most useful in trauma cases. It's a system of care that puts together all of the sorts of treatment that any one patient might need. And that includes care at the scene, life-saving manoeuvres at the scene of injury, pre-hospital care through ambulance services in Australia, early reception and resuscitation in hospital, and then the whole treatment course through hospital and after hospital to restore function and recovery.
As you say, helping the patient survive trauma is just the first step, and rehabilitation comes after that. How far have we come in that area?
Well, one of the reasons we're doing this project and the Indians have been keen to work with us is that Australia has proven that systems of care do work. They work for the early care. You're half as likely to die from serious injury in Victoria now than you were 10 years ago at the start of the Victorian State Trauma System. So it's a proven effectiveness. But we also now have good knowledge about what the consequences of severe injury are 1, 2, 3 years down the track. And we have that knowledge through interviewing and examining patients and finding out how much pain they have, whether they have any mental health problems, whether they've returned to work, what their physical function is like, and what their quality of life is like. And that information has been very useful first in describing the previously really unknown burden of injury on society. We realise how much of a problem the long-term disability is and how we can promote recovery through better targeted rehabilitation strategies. So one of the things we'll be doing in India is testing whether in a system without organised rehabilitation centres like we might have in Australia, are there ways of getting the sorts of physical treatments and the cognitive treatments that perhaps a family member could support after a patient goes home from hospital.
And just briefly, Professor, tell us about the Alfred Hospital's collaborative efforts elsewhere in the Asia-Pacific region. Have you been to other countries in the region?
The Alfred Hospital has a large international program that's been supporting trauma development throughout the Asia-Pacific region for many, many years. The most notable things have been rebuilding a hospital in Gaul in Sri Lanka after the tsunami, working in the Philippines, in China, in Indonesia, in Thailand and in Myanmar to strengthen the systems of care, to train the emergency and trauma care providers, to build collaborations around data collection and to foster collaboration in the region. The Alfred has been really a model health service to use its skills and its capacity, of which it's developed very substantially over the last few decades, to be one of the premier trauma and emergency centres in not just Australia, but in Asia and the world.
And finally on the program, the well-known Samoan rugby union player Peter Fatolov has died suddenly at age 54. Peter Fats, as he was known, is understood to have suffered a heart attack while driving in Samoa. He played for Manu Samoa between 1988 and 1996 and competed in 2 Rugby Union World Cups. He worked in a furniture removal business and was called New Zealand's most famous piano mover. Bruce Hill spoke to Glenn Wallstrom, chairman of Auckland Rugby, about his life and career.
Yeah, it has been. Obviously, it came as a surprise to everybody, myself included. And he was as large in life in Auckland and New Zealand, and in the Samoan community. So we sadly missed in that regard.
He was known pretty popularly as Peter Fats, you know, from Fatialofa. Did he mind that at all?
No, he loved it. I think if you look at his last act in life in the business world, back in Samoa, I think he started up a touring company called Fats Tours. So it was a good brand that he managed to, I suppose, nurture and live by in the end. And that was a nickname that most of them have, and he enjoyed that one.
He was quite young when he died, wasn't he? I mean, it must have come as a surprise to everyone. Did people know that he'd been ill?
No one had. And I suppose more particularly because he was living in Samar at the time. And prior to that, probably the last 20 months, he was in Auckland, and he was part of the Auckland Samoan representation on the Auckland Rugby Union Council of Delegates. And I used to see him regularly at those monthly meetings. And it was just in the last 6 months that people were asking where he was and not realising he'd gone home. So he quite stuck home and unfortunately passed away over there. But with his family, I suppose, all the better.
Tell us about his reputation and what he's meant to the game of rugby, both in Samoa and also in New Zealand.
Well, I suppose if I start off in New Zealand, he started with Ponsonby and played right through with the Ponsonby Rugby Club here in Auckland, which is one of the oldest clubs in New Zealand and one of the strongest, I suppose, in the Auckland Provincial Union. And from there, he went on to play for Auckland from about 84 through to about 92, and represented Auckland for 71 occasions. And in that period, went on to play for Manu Samoa and obviously captaining the side of the 91 World Cup team. In that era that he played for Auckland, he was actually coached by a fellow Samoan and Brian Williams, and ably assisted by Maurice Trapp at the time. And in that era, they had the Renfrew Shield and held it for 60-odd challenges. So he was the keeper of that shield. And that was probably very apt that he looked after it, because he was sort of, I suppose, larger than life, big as a bear, and was able to look after everybody plus the shield at the same time. So that created quite a bit of talk amongst the rugby community at the time.
There were so many great Samoan players in New Zealand at that time that the joke was that Manu Samoa should be referred to as New Zealand B.
Well, that's right. I suppose you could say that. New Zealand has the biggest Polynesian population in the world, including their own islands. So in that regard, he was basically very much a leader of the Polynesian community, in particular Samoans. And his transitioning post Auckland, or during Auckland's playing time with Auckland, I should say, and into the international arena, into Manu Samoa, was probably very appropriate in that he was able to take his skills both on and off the field back to his homeland and represent his country very proudly on the international arena.
Now, you knew him in two capacities, as an official but also on the field as a referee. Tell me what he was like as a person and what kind of interactions you had with Peter Fatiolofa.
My recollection of his playing on the field was that, first of all, he was a great sportsman. He used to, obviously, and he was larger than life in terms of personality by size. He used his size in terms of his brute strength. And because he was ahead of the professional era in his time in playing, he actually was probably one of the strong men of the front row forwards in those days. And people looked up to him for his strengths and his skills, and he used those. And he pulled people along and taught them some of what should have been, I suppose, that we see today in the professional environment of strength and, I suppose, some of the skills that are seen now, that where players are spending a lot of time on a 24-hour, 7-day-week type cycle that he brought to the game earlier on. Look, he was, as I said, he was a great sportsman. He gave both the opposition and the referee, myself, at times a bit of a chip, but it was all in good spirit. And what stayed on the field happened out there and remained there. And he was very convivial, and he was very sort of sportsmanlike post the fixtures. So it was a good character to have around, actually.
And with that, we end this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. So until next time, so long, take care. We'll see you again in 7 days.